I think the solution is rescuing kids from that system and creating an educational model and a childhood that reflects humanity and honors individuality.
Hello. Welcome again to an episode of the Let People Prosper Show. My name is Dr. Vance Ginn. I hope you're having a prosperous day. Well, today I'm delighted to have someone on who's helping kids learn about free markets and education and the history of America and so much more. And he's also pushing for school choice and freedom for so many people across the country. And it's none other than Connor Boyack. Connor, welcome to the Let People Prosper Show.
Thanks for having me on, Vance. Looking forward to chatting.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. It's really a pleasure to have you on. I've been following your work for a while. Just for the audience, I have the Miraculous Pencil. I've got the whole set of the Tuttle Twins. If you don't have these yet, you should get them. Also have the recent book, America's History, which is another part of the Tuttle Twins series that the audience should check out. And then we're also going to talk about Mediocrity, another book that he wrote with Corey DeAngelis, who's a good friend. 40 Ways Government Schools Are Failing Today's Students. So we're going to talk a lot about those things. But before we get too far, let me give people your bio, and then we'll jump right into it. So this is what he has on his website at ConnorBoyack.com. It says, I have won awards, spoken on a lot of stages, and many people have said nice things about me. But I take the most pride in the personal impact my work has on others, the child who learns how the world really works through our Tuttle Twins books, the elderly woman whose medicine is no longer banned, the ex-convict whose life is no longer ruined by the government for years after release, or the hustling teenager who launches their entrepreneurial venture at one of our markets, even lemonade stands or something like that. He's addicted to changing the world for the better, one life at a time. He primarily does that through the nonprofit he founded, Libertas Institute. Great one. Y'all should all go check it out. It's one of the country's most impactful think tanks that helps reform policies in his home state and across the nation. So with all that, Connor, let me start off by asking you, like I do every guest, why do you do what you do every day?
Well, I am someone who is deeply distrusting of authority figures. I see a lot of corruption and a lot of, I'm a historian, an amateur historian, so I see all the problems of the past, but I also see them in the present. But I am kind of the Gandhi quote, be the change you wish to see in the world. I have in my DNA not just to have opinions and to say someone ought to do something about it, but to actually go and do it. My background, I was a web developer. I have an IT background, but I just on the side started getting involved, started speaking out. And it just grew into starting a think tank and writing now, I think, 44 books and public speaking and all the rest, just because, not a lot of people stand up, not a lot of people speak out, not a lot of people say, we got to change this. And so despite not having any formal background, being an attorney or an economist or anything, I engage in all those issues in the public sphere with legislatures, with elected officials, and really try and stand up and give voice to people who share my values, share our ideas, but they're busy, they have jobs, they have families and so forth. I try and with my team, give them voice and a platform where we can affect change.
Yeah, that's
together.
Awesome. And at Libertas, which is in Utah, how many people work there these days?
Well, so our organization is inclusive both of our policy work, which is kind of the think tank side, but then the Tuttle Twins that you mentioned, that's part of it. So it's within our nonprofit. And then we also have a project called the Children's Entrepreneur Market. So kind of the lemonade stand you were talking about, we're scaling that across the country and creating entrepreneurial experiences for kids. So all these projects are kind of blended together within the Libertas umbrella. And total, we probably have, I'd say, 80, 90 people working with us now, somewhere around there. And it's growing quite quickly because a lot of these are national initiatives that I think are very well timed. A lot of families, are hungry for freedom, or they want their kids to experience more entrepreneurship rather than entitlement. They want them to be more value creators for other people and servant leaders in the community rather than just, entitled spoiled brats kind of thing. So there's a lot of demand for what we're doing. And frankly, to be clear, you come from kind of this freedom movement. You know how a lot of these organizations work. Most of our organizations that focus on these ideas talk to adults only. They talk to voters, right? And that's important. I don't want to say we shouldn't do that. We absolutely should do that. But oftentimes adults are very set in their worldview and in their ways, and it's very difficult to persuade them or change their minds. And so we are one of the very, very few organizations that focuses on the rising generation, on families, bringing the ideas of free markets and capitalism and individual liberty to the family unit where kids and parents can learn together and then apply these ideas together in their life, in their home economy, in their little businesses that they spin off. So that's our sweet spot, is having this family focus with freedom and giving kids and their parents education and experiences that can help them learn and then apply.
Yeah, that's fantastic,
ideas.
Connor. And it shows with all the work that you do. And before we start recording, I was telling you about how my 6-year-old and 9-year-old boys, they're already reading these books. And then we just started watching the cartoon on the Tuttle Twins, which is on Angel, the app. And they love that as well. So the audience should go check those out, because it provides a lot of key insights that I think adults can learn from as well. But for the kids, and it's kind of fun to watch. I watch it with them.
Well, Vance, you just clued in. I'll say briefly on the secret sauce of what we're doing. Think of it this way. If you know, you're a PhD economist, you've written, you know, white papers and journal articles and all the rest, right? And a lot of our think tanks produce, you know, books and materials for adults, for individuals to learn. Again, very important. But if you stop the average Joe on the side of the road and say, hey, here's The Road to Serfdom by Hayek, or here's, you know, Nate, pick your book, right? Basic Economics by Sowell or whatever. The average Joe, I would say under 5% of individuals that you stop on the road would, number one, take the book from you, and number two, go home and actually read it. By contrast, if I go to that average Joe and I say, hey, Joe, do you have kids? Yeah, I've got a, you know, 12-year-old, 10-year-old, whatever. Awesome. Hey, do you think it's important for them to learn about how markets work or how to be successful in life and so forth? I think, you know, every parent says yes, every caring parent. And then I say, great, here's some materials that can help you teach your kids about these ideas. And so what happens is, before, if I'm saying, Joe, here's this book you need to read, I'm implying that Joe's an idiot, that he lacks knowledge, that you know, here, you need to learn. Joe's going to get defensive. No, I'm busy. I don't need that. I'm fine. You know, whatever. But if I go through Joe to his kids, if I'm helping Joe help his kids, his barrier is down. He's not defensive. And then he is learning alongside his kids, because based on our last survey, 58% of our parents say that they are learning new things for the first time, despite buying the books for their kids. And so their defenses are down. They're learning as a family. And that's where I think the sweet spot is. You've probably heard the quote, politics is downstream of culture. We say this all the time in our kind of think tanky world. I agree with it. I think that's true. I just think it's incomplete. Yes, politics is downstream of culture, but culture is downstream of the family. And our movement, despite being very pro-family, doesn't really cater to families, doesn't attract them, doesn't support them, doesn't teach them as a whole. And so that's really our MO, is leaning into that space and saying, we got to support families to drive the culture to affect the political change.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. What got you to this point in your thinking in the free market world? Was it a book you read? Was it a class you took? Or how did you get to where you're at in your thinking about free markets?
So I come from a Republican household, but just a generic one. We didn't really, you know, my mom was on the city council, but we never really, you know, talked much politics. I didn't really have a deep philosophical upbringing. When I was in college, though, my grandpa started feeding me a lot of articles, a lot of essays and books that talked about like free market economics, American history. And I dabbled a little bit in them, but I didn't really go deep. But then as I graduated college, I was invited to a screening of a new documentary that had just come out. This was 2005, 2006, called America, Freedom to Fascism. And it's by Aaron Russo. He's since passed away, but it was his attempt to chart the kind of classical liberal ideals of the American founding and then map how they've just degraded over time with specific examples. Well, one person interviewed in that documentary just made a ton of sense. And everything that he said is like, wow, that has clarity. That rings true. Who is this guy? Well, it was Congressman Ron Paul. And that was my first exposure to him. And so I Googled Ron Paul. He had like a recommended reading list. I watched a bajillion C-SPAN videos of him. And so from his reading list, I then did a deep dive into, you know, Austrian economics and history and political economy. And so he was kind of my gateway drug into these ideas. And then from there, just went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. And there's so many people who got kind of on the free market libertarian sort of streak from Ron Paul. And I was definitely a fan and am a fan. And so that's definitely a good way to go. Mine was Capitalism and Freedom, a more nerdy one, I guess. But I remember my intermediate macroeconomics at Texas Tech University, where I went, who would be my mentor over time. And one day I was talking to him after class. I was like, you know, what books would you recommend? And that's what he handed me was Capitalism and Freedom. And it kind of like blew my mind. It was like, I've already been thinking this way. And now there's someone else who's explaining this, who's well-respected and everything else, kind of to the Ron Paul point, where it's remarkable to learn about how people get on these tracks. You hear so many different things. Right. And I guess you're hearing that now maybe from some kids or teenagers from the Tuttle Twins, right?
Oh, I'll give you an example that some of your listeners may have seen or heard of. So last fall, there was a 12-year-old kid named Jaden in Colorado Springs. And he's a very patriotic kid. And on his backpack, he has a bunch of patches. One of them was the Gadsden flag, the yellow "Don't Tread on Me" flag. And so he goes to class. Mind you, this is a classical charter school in Colorado Springs, founded to champion civic virtue, American history, and all the rest. So keep that in mind as I share the story. Well, he's in class, and the class teacher complains to the vice principal about this patch, the Gadsden flag patch. And so the vice principal calls the mom in, sits Jaden down with mom. To her credit, mom secretly recorded this conversation. She turned her phone on and got video of the whole thing. The vice principal proceeds to tell the mom that Jaden is now kicked out of school unless and until he removes the patch from his backpack. Why, she asks. Well, it's because the patch, that Gadsden flag, has origins in slavery and therefore is a disruption to the classroom environment, and which is totally wrong. I mean, it's an anti-British flag. You know, the snake, Benjamin Franklin had the flag that said "Unite or Die," and it was the 13 pieces of the snake. The idea that the rattlesnake is a defensive creature, it's not going to go out and just attack random people, but it's going to, you know, warn you first, and then it's going to defend you. So it's this very kind of anti-British pro-freedom thing. The vice principal is totally wrong. So they're driving home because Jaden wanted to stand his ground. He's like, I don't want to take this patch off. So they're driving home from school. Jaden turns to his mom while in the car and says, "Hey, mom, in the Tuttle Twins and the food truck fiasco, when the twins have a problem with the government, they got the media involved. Do you think we could get some media to, you know, talk to a reporter?" Mom, again, to her credit, was like, okay, let's try. She drives him straight over to the NBC News affiliate, the local affiliate. He goes up to the front doorbell, rings the security, you know, camera doorbell. No one would come out and talk to him. And so he's kind of sulking. They're trying to figure out, what do we do now? And he's like, hey, can we reach out to Mr. Boyack? And so the mom DMs me on Twitter, shares the video. I'm watching this video. I'm like, oh, this is golden. Like, I knew it would go viral. So with her consent and full buy-in, the following morning, I share it on Twitter. And it got over 50 million views, went mega viral, libs of TikTok, and everyone starts sharing it, right? And so Jaden, you know, the school quickly backed down because people were calling on the phone and emailing and all this stuff. So Jaden was getting a lot of press now about this. And among all the interviews he did, one was with Ben Shapiro. I think it was that afternoon or the following day. So they're talking for a while. And Ben finally was like, You seem to know a lot about American history and like, how is it that you know so much? You're 12 years old. And so Jaden says, well, I give credit to my mom and to Connor Boyack and his Tuttle Twins books. And I was like, all right, man, here's a $5 bill. Good job giving a plug on the show. So to me, like, that's what it's about. What would the world look like? Just like Ron Paul was influential for me. If I and my team can play that role for other people, right, plant those seeds, what does the world look like 20, 30 years from now if we've planted all these seeds that we're going to then cultivate and fertilize over time? I get really hopeful, you know, because there's a lot to be pessimistic about in our world and the economy and everything going on. But this project gives me so much hope for the future that if we really lean into this moment and educate kids with our values and ideas, man, that could be a whole world of difference.
Yeah. Amen, man. I'm getting goosebumps, like chills, just thinking about that, because I mean, that's the ultimate thing we want to do. I mean, my kind of calling is Let People Prosper. That's why I named this podcast Let People Prosper. I got in a really serious car accident. Like, I was a rock drummer in my late teens, and I was living the rock star life. Okay. And I got in a bad car accident.
That's hard to imagine about you.
And I got in a bad car accident. We rolled 6 times. I got life-flighted to the hospital. I was in bed for like a month. And I was kind of like praying about, thinking about where my life was heading. And that's where this whole idea of Let People Prosper came in. Like, I feel like that was my calling. And I've been doing that, first generation college graduate, you know, once got to work at the White House, TVPF, all this other stuff. And now I get to talk to folks like you. But it's like, I can see that in you as kind of your calling. Did you find that was your calling, that this is what you were meant to be? Like, where every day is just, you're blessed to be able to go and do it. It's not even like a job anymore. Yeah,
totally. It's all play. It's like this. I tell people I have no hobbies. Literally, this is my hobby. Like, I'm just so passionate about it. And it's the trite quote everyone's heard, like, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life kind of thing. When I used to be a web developer, I loathed Monday mornings and I loved Friday afternoons, like a lot of people in a 9-to-5 that they don't necessarily love. And now, you know, I love my family and everything, don't get me wrong, but Friday afternoons, I'm like, oh, you know, and then Monday mornings, I'm like, all right, let's go. Because I feel like it's so important, not just like, here's a little kind of history ditty. I remember John Adams, he would write to Abigail a lot, deeply critical of like Tom Paine during the early days, but then also like the French Revolution when that was happening. And the current theme in these criticisms that he had was, it's very easy to tear down. Like with Tom Paine, he's like, yeah, sure, fine, the king sucks, and you know, there's all these problems with monarchy and everything. I get it, right? And with the French Revolution, he's like, yeah, okay, things are bad over there. It's easy to tear down, it's easy to point fingers. But what Adams was critical of was that he didn't like Tom Paine's proffered solutions, and he didn't know what the solutions in France were. He didn't really see many people. So when he's writing to Abigail, he's like, it's super easy to criticize, but where are the people who understand, you know, political governance and understand human nature and understand philosophy that can really rebuild in the right way? Now, I've got quibbles with some of the stuff Adams does, like Alien and Sedition Acts and some of these other things. I'm not holding him up as some, you know, model beacon or whatever. But I think what he pinpointed is right. It is really easy in our world to criticize, to point fingers, to blame. And there's an abundance of that. I mean, just look at social media. It's harder, though, to come up with solutions and then go actually try and apply those solutions. So that's what gets me excited, is just having the organization and the team and the capacity, the donors and everyone to support us in actually going to affect solutions, whether we're talking policy reform in legislatures around the country or this longer term solution of really getting into the family and planting those seeds for the future. It's just, as you can imagine, as you can appreciate, it's very gratifying to be kind of a solution provider rather than just on the, you know, sidelines, you know, shaking your fist and complaining about things. It's great to be able to offer solutions and say, let's pursue this to make the world
a little better. Well, keep doing that. Keep doing what you're doing. And I wondered too, like, how do you come up with some of these, the different ones? For example, I'm holding right now Tell Twins and the Miraculous Pencil, which kind of goes through Leonard Reed's idea of the pencil, right, and everything. And and you're able to explain it in a great way. And, you know, my 9-year-old, he was like, explaining it to me, and it was awesome, like seeing him be able to come back and explain it that way. But I wonder how you come up with these different ideas that are been out there forever, but put them in a way that kids can understand.
Well, initially, so we have books now for toddlers. Yep. We have books for teenagers. The books that you were pointing out, that's our kind of children's elementary age series, and the format of that series is that we take the classic books in kind of the free market world writ large, and we kind of we take their 5 to 7 core ideas, and then we distill them down, simplify them, and then wrap a story around them. So all of those children's books are kind of inspired by or based off of kind of classic books or essays. So our very first one was The Law by Frederick Bastiat. That one, our second one that you pointed out, was I, Pencil by Leonard Reed. We've got The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Road to Serfdom, Atlas Shrugged, right? And so when we started early on, it was like, hey, what are the great books for Elijah and I? Elijah is my partner and the illustrator of our books. For him and I, it's like, what are the like powerful ideas and really awesome books that we want to kind of pay homage to and carry on their ideas to the next generation? So that's how we did it for the first few years. More recently, what we've fallen into is this idea of, let's try and respond to the moment that we're in. So for example, when COVID was happening and all the authoritarianism and the lockdowns and everything else, we decided to do a book inspired by Bob Higgs's Crisis of Leviathan, which for the uninitiated is a kind of a more academic-y type of analysis of how in past decades, whenever there has been some type of crisis, typically an economic or a kind of military political crisis, the government has substantially grown because the government says, oh, we got to do all this spending. We need these new programs.
It's an emergency. You know, World War II, you know? Can't let a crisis go to waste.
Exactly. It's an emergency. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Rahm Emanuel. But what Bob Higgs talks about in his book is if you look at these examples, the government grows under an emergency-based justification, but then it rarely, if yeah. ever, retracts. That becomes the new baseline from which they then expand further. And so we said, you know, that book would be so powerful right now, because right now everyone's scared of this, you know, virus. And so here we are responding with all this tyranny and restricting all these rights in the name of keeping yeah. people safe. And what's going to happen? Well, the government is going to have all these new kind of powers and programs and policies that aren't going to go away. They might get reduced. They might get renamed. Mm-hmm. They might get put on pause for a little bit. But the government now has this new kind of purported authority that it can use in the future. So then we said, all right, let's do that book. And so our book became The Tuttle Twins and the Leviathan Crisis. And then, you know, now that our world is just a mess and we have all these cultural problems and problems with the youth and all this propaganda and everything, we said, you know, Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life is doing really well with the young adults and trying to get them to be like, you know, good, clear thinking, actionable people who understand, you know, themselves and the world around them. And so we took 12 Rules for Life and we adapted it for kids. Ours is called the Tuttle Twins and the 12 Rules Boot Camp. And so a lot of what we're doing now is just trying to say, like, what message do families need right now to support their kids? The one that we're working on right now, I haven't publicly announced this, so I think this might be the first time, but I'll share it with you and your audience since we're talking about it. We're working on our next book, number 14 in that series. And I think it's going to be called The Tuttle Twins and the... I just forgot the title. But the story, though, is all around kind of DEI and cultural Marxism. So it takes place in a kind of a relay race where there's unfair advantage given to people who did not earn it. And you got this kind of oppressor versus oppressed dynamic. And so we talk about Marx and economic Marxism, but now this cultural Marxism and the dynamic that we see infesting organizations and institutions across our society. We feel like that's a message that we need to hear right now, that we do need to restore the notion of merit and hard work and get away from all this kind of DEI, ESG kind of stuff that we have infecting our institutions. So that's kind of the pattern that we're in now. What's the message that families need to hear to be able to talk to their kids right now, give them a language to understand what's going on in the world? And then we'll do the book based on that.
Idea. It's fantastic. Well, I like to hear that too. It's also based on current events and things that are influencing our daily lives. I often say that it's infiltrating, not just influencing, it's infiltrating our lives in so many ways. And it's unfortunate, you know? And I think when we're looking at these different issues, I'm glad you brought up kind of the pandemic and everything else, because there was a lot of lessons, I think, for those of us who are more on the free market side. And so at the time I was at the White House, so I was at there from June 2019 to May of 2020, right when all this stuff was going on. And I was at the Situation Room and I was writing memos saying we should not lock everything down. And I was trying as much as I could. But you're right in the sense of just think about how much more we spent during that period from the Trump administration. And then it kind of went on steroids under the Biden administration, but it gave them the tools to then say, let's keep this going. You know, if the next emergency comes, let's just use this more to expand government and maybe it'll expire and go away. But that's not what we're seeing. I mean, the latest budget proposal by Biden is $7.3 trillion. When I was there, it was $4.6 trillion. And I already thought that was too much, you know? And so they just keep, you're exactly right. They just keep building on that. And I really wonder, how can we explain this in a way that, look, it's budget inertia. It's growth of government in inertia. They don't really look and see, are these effective or ineffective programs? They just keep it on autopilot and keep it going. And I wonder kind of what your thoughts are on whether it be a state government, local government, or federal government, of we've just got too much government going on, which is infiltrating our lives.
I kind of buy into the fourth turning model, if you've ever heard of that. This was a book written back in, like, I think the 80s by Neil Strauss and Howe. I can't remember the other guy's name. But they charted Western civilization, and we all know it's kind of cyclical, right? That quote that says, like, good times create, you know, weak men create hard times create strong men create good times. And so they came up with all these examples of how history in Western civilization specifically is cyclical. And then this idea that, okay, we're going to now go through hard times again, and then we're going to have to rebuild. And out of that, we're going to have leaders and strong men, so-called, and women, obviously, who can help rebuild society. So I'm not a fatalist, but I do believe there is kind of an inevitability about the consequences of past mismanagement and misallocation of resources that we just kind of
Yeah.
have to get through. And we, you know, we're not magically going to solve today. And so what I see my role as and my team is, you know, we're on the Titanic and we're about to hit the iceberg. And it's such a big ship that you can't really move it anymore. And so the best thing that we can be doing is, you know, not rearranging the deck chairs, not, you know, fiddling while Rome burns or anything like that. No, let's get the families on the lifeboats, right? Let's get as many individuals to safety. But why is that important? Not just for safety, on a little life raft or a little speedboat, you can more nimbly get around that iceberg and other obstacles in the water. And so I think localism is important. And by localism, I mean families individually, not necessarily municipalities. Really empowering families to learn these ideas and say, look, we may go through some hard times. We're going to have to pay the bill. We can't just, you know, keep this fiat regime up and inflate it forever. Things are going to, you know, we're going to have a problem at some point. And so maybe that's coming soon. And if so, hey, can your family be financially prepared? Can you be economically literate? Can you have strong moral leadership in your family, in your community, to be able to help, you know, your family and your neighbors weather the storm? Can you prepare even just like have food storage and financial, you know, reserves and things like that? I think that's the important message right now, because, again, I feel like we're going to be going through some kind of hard times. A lot of us, you know, are already right now and have been for the past few years. And so the better we can help families weather that storm, and then in the process, identify who are those leaders, so that when it is time to rebuild, right, we've torn down the problems, we've kind of cleared out the misallocation of resources, we've fired all the DEI people and all the woke, you know, weirdos and everything else. Okay, great, now it's time to rebuild. Okay, who are the leaders? Who are the people that are going to help us with that? And I think the time to prepare for that is now.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder what your thoughts are, Connor, about kind of where we see progressivism coming in. We've had this from the left for a long time, but I think we're seeing this a lot more on the right, where they're just saying government is the solution. For example, there's the big debate between like the national conservatives and the freedom conservatives. And I'm a signatory on the freedom conservatives side. And but there's been this debate about the NatCons basically saying, look, we've been on this Reagan sort of libertarianism is what they like to call it. And that's created the situations that we're in today. And my thought is where has that been? Where's that libertarianism been? Because we've continued to ratchet up deficits and debt. And it seems like, and I want to get your thoughts on this, Connor, to me, it seems like they're considering it to be a market failure and the government can come in and solve the problem if we just have the right people to stack the decks, without looking at the issue, the underlying problem being government failure. And you can't solve government failure with more government. And so I think we're heading in the wrong direction, but I wonder what your thoughts are on this.
I remember, wasn't it Tucker Carlson who a few months ago was like blaming libertarianism for all of the economic, you know, havoc that was at, like, so that similar argument you're talking about. But even Tucker, you know, who used to be a Ron Paul guy and used to be kind of very libertarian leaning, falling into this like NatCon perspective and focusing on this like populist rhetoric that, oh, if only we can wield the ring of power, right, then we can like create this utopia. And I think it was the Abraham Lincoln who said, never give your friend a power you wouldn't want your enemy to wield, or something to that effect, right? It's one thing when I think of like Harry Reid and the filibuster in the Senate, right? And they were even warned, like, don't do this, because and so then the Republicans use the filibuster and then they can, you know, get all their people on the Supreme Court. But that's a consequence of what the Democrats did. So you get this myopia where these people in D.C. and frankly all over the place focus on doing what's good for us, this short-term dopamine hit, getting what we want, instant gratification, you know, for this political whatever. But they don't, it's totally Bastiat, right? That which is not seen. You get all these like narrow-minded people that see the short-term effects, but they don't contemplate the long-term effects. We haven't had a free market libertarian anything. If we want to look for an example, I'm looking at Javier Milei. Here's the guy taking the chainsaw to the government. Inflation is actually slowing down. Rents are coming down. That like they're actually see a path out of their economic problems, despite how horrible they were. And there's a light at the end of the tunnel for them, precisely because here is this Austrian economist guy who, to the extent possible, because he has he's got a Congress he has to work with, but to the extent possible, he's instituting all these reforms And to me, like, that's going to be a fascinating case study because I think it's going to help us put to rest this nonsense that, oh, this all these problems in America are because of this, freewheeling laissez-faire. And I'm like,
Yeah.
where is that? I haven't seen that. Where is this laissez-faire you
Yeah,
speak of?
exactly, man. It's something else. And, I think you really got to go back to maybe a Calvin Coolidge, a century ago.
Right.
I think a lot, I think actually think a
Yeah.
lot of our founding fathers, Jefferson and some of these others were much more libertarian, classical liberal is what I like to call myself, than what we have
Yeah.
today. And people don't see it. I mean, I think Hamilton kind of took us in the wrong direction on a centralized bank and more centralized government. But they were pushing hard for this stuff. And now I think they'd be rolling over in their grave with how big the government is and how much it's infiltrating all of our lives. Speaking of that, though, this latest, well, I don't know if it's your latest book because you're coming out with so many books, but Mediocrity, which I'm holding up right now, is the 40 ways government schools are failing today's students. It's a great book, and I like it too, Connor, because it has really short chapters. So with me and my little bit of ADD that I have, I'm like, hey, I can read this chapter and I learn something that I come back to it later. And I know you wrote this with Corey DeAngelis, who's been out there all over the place. He's always doing this. And now it's been something else with school choice. And we've got at least 10 that are universal school choice states that have passed this and maybe more to come, like in Louisiana, where I do some work, and hopefully Texas will do it soon. But with your
Hopefully.
education stuff, for with Tuttle Twins and everything else, how did this all get connected now with school choice? What do you think is so important about
Well, I think the government corrodes everything that
that?
it touches. I mean, that's kind of my libertarian ethos, right? And so, just like I believe in a separation of church and state, I believe in a separation of education and state. I think the government has done a piss poor job when it comes, and the data supports me. That's not some cockamamie libertarian theory. That's very clearly backed up by the facts. And the way I tell the story is that recently in the news there was this group that wrote about our economic condition. They actually spent 18 months going around the country on a listening tour, talking to families, teachers, educators, reviewing curricula, looking at test scores. Spent a year and a half doing this, and then they issued a report at the conclusion. Just came out in the news very recently. And in this report, they said, among other things, that there was a rising tide of mediocrity that threatened to overwhelm America's educational foundations. And further, that if a foreign government, they said, had attempted to impose upon America the very mediocre educational performance that now exists today, we might have viewed it as an act of
Wow.
war. As it stands, we've allowed this to happen to ourselves.
Jeez.
And so the reveal here is that I fibbed a little bit. This group did not recently spend 18 months doing this or recently issue this report. It was April
Wow.
1983. The
Yeah.
Reagan administration published this report. They were called the National Commission on Excellence in Education. And in the early 80s, their conclusion was that in America, the government school system was pumping out mediocrity. So when I share this with audiences, I'll then say, okay, raise of hand, who here thinks that education has materially improved in the last 40 years? And of course, no one raises their hands because, despite your opinion on school choice or whatever, everyone knows that, like, it hasn't
Yeah.
gotten better. There's probably some four-letter words that we can use that would actually represent, what it is today. So Corey and I, the purpose of the book, we actually published it on the 40th anniversary. So April 26, 2023, that was 40 years to the day from when that
Wow.
report came out. And so we have 40 chapters. It was actually also my 40th book that I
Nice.
published. It was kind of a weird, weird universe thing all
Yeah.
conspiring together. But the idea was, we get a lot of biases, right? Oh, I went to public school and I turned out fine. Or, oh, things aren't like I see on libs of TikTok. That's an isolated thing. Or, yeah, there's that news story. The intent of our book, Corey and I, is to kind of be a machine gun fire at the reader and say, here's a ton of examples backed up by data, backed up by all these stories that you have to take seriously. Like, if you want to put your kids in a government school,
Yeah.
knock yourself out. But be intentional about that. Don't assume the best. Don't kind of go path of least resistance and blindly kind of take that action. Be very aware of what you're doing. Be very intentional. But frankly, like, ultimately, we think kids should be rescued from that system because it's so dehumanizing and deficient in its educational performance. So that is why, I am an ad I want the government out. I want taxpayer dollars out. I want everything out of education. But that is not
Yeah.
our world. That is not in the Overton window to completely defund, education. And so my position, and this has controversy in kind of the more free market libertarian. There are people who disagree. disagree with this, and I think they have reasonable arguments. But my position is that if we accept that taxpayer dollars are going to flow into education, I would prefer that they be utilized in a competitive environment where we can have choice for parents and the competitive pressure on the system that will yield, you know, lower prices and better outcomes rather than dumping it into a pseudo monopoly. And so, you know, I don't love that taxpayer dollars are the ones, you know, flowing into private schools and homeschools or whatever. That's not my ideal. My ideal is to just, you know, divorce it completely and let people keep their own money rather than taxing them. But if the system in which we live is such that we are all being taxed for education, I want that money going to the parents, not to the bureaucracies, and letting the parents decide how it's going to be spent on behalf of their kids.
Yeah, well put there. I always like what Corey says, fund students, not systems. I think that's a key part of this. And education savings accounts is it's a different paradigm compared with when Milton Friedman was talking about this with vouchers for where you could take money going to a government school. I don't call them public schools either because there's nothing public about them. I don't know what a public is. But anyway, a government school, and you give it to another institution like a private school. That's a voucher, whereas education savings accounts, just for the audience, is that the money is going to the parents. And then the parents get to decide with that account if they go to government school, private school, homeschool, co-op, tutoring, you name it, education-related expenses that would be approved by some entity within the government or whatever. But at the end of the day, it should be about meeting the needs of the unique needs of each one of their kids. I mean, I've got three kids. Each one of them are so different. And if one-size-fits-all government role, which I really believe is a form of socialism, or it is socialism, from our system that we have today in government schools, is bad. And by the way, Connor, I mean, I've done a lot of research too on school finance. The school finance system is so complicated in each state. In Texas, I mean, it's just mind-blowingly bad about what they're doing there and then trying to get the money out. I've actually just wrote a piece talking about we need to reform the school finance through education savings accounts to where that is the school finance. You can have a three-page bill that says here is education savings accounts. The money is going to go out to the kids based on X amount of money and, you know, to do some other things. But the parents are the ultimate in accountability. They're the ones that are going to put the money. And if it doesn't work, then they move somewhere else. They do something else. We'll see the outcomes improve dramatically. And I really do feel like this is the biggest thing that we can do to reduce poverty, to provide more prosperity for the future and everything else. And, you know, I don't know if you have anything else to add to that as we wrap up here, but I really appreciate all that you're working on this.
Thank you. And no, I think you're exactly right. The more choice we can empower parents to have, I think then it also helps parents be more in the driver's seat, right? So often kids are the passengers in the back of the bus of their own life. Other people have the wheel. Other people are directing where they go and what they're doing. We have this notion in the government school system that every child must learn the same thing at the same age in the same way as every other kid, right? This kind of commonality that's just absurd. Like, as you say, our kids are all unique. They learn differently. They're passionate about different things. They have different futures. Why are we trying to homogenize them all under a single standard, this collectivist idea? Why not create a system that reflects the diversity of thought and paths in life, talents, abilities, that reflects actual, you know, humanity? I think government schools, it's just an artificial system. You and I don't learn by like, I think there's two models in learning. One is called a just-in-case model, and the other is just-in-time. So the school system is a just-in-case, right? You must memorize the quadratic equation just in case in 30 years you're going to be in a profession that requires it. You must know that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell just in case you ever need it, right?
Yeah.
That's absurd. None of us learn that way. We all learn with a just-in-time model. If my refrigerator breaks, just in time to fix it, I'm going to go pull out the manual. I'm going to watch a YouTube video. I'm going to call my uncle who's really good with that kind of thing, right? And I assemble the information I need from disparate sources just in time for when I need that information and when I apply it. So it's far more important to be equipping kids with knowledge about where to find information. AI, I think, offers a lot of promise and excitement here, actually. And that is the model that we as humans authentically learn. So for me, I see modern kind of government schools as this artificial experiment that's been foisted on humanity that has caused myriad problems. And to the extent ESAs can help and other initiatives, micro schools is a really exciting thing right now. And certainly I'm a fan of homeschooling. We homeschool our kids. But the more that we can do to pursue these alternatives, I see it as this pro-humanity thing, not just, oh, we're going to have better educational outcomes. I see this as how we save the world. And so many of the political and social problems that we have are downstream of this system that we've had for the past century and a half or more. And so I think the solution is rescuing kids from that system and creating an educational model and a childhood that reflects humanity and honors individuality. And so that's what I'm passionate about and what a lot of our work, both on the policy side at Libertas, but then also Tuttle Twins, centers around.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate all you're doing and for being on the show today. God bless you and your family, Cotter. Thanks
Thank
so
you.
much. And for the audience, please go and give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to this, and you can find it on your major platforms. And be sure to rate and review it, and then also share with your friends and family. They may need to learn this information as well. And go check out the Tuttle Twins, Mediocrity, and so much more, and Libertas in general, with Cotter Bowiak. And I'll put all this in the show notes page at bandscan.substack.com. Until next time, let people prosper.